You're about to listen to the Complete Developer Podcast, the podcast by coders and for coders about all aspects of life as a developer.
I'm Will, the curmudgeonly experienced developer.
And I'm Beege, the optimistic newbie developer.
Welcome to another episode of Complete Developer Podcast. Before we get started, Will, what have you been fighting this week?
I've been fighting WinForms.
Really?
Yeah, and it's embarrassing. I actually had to port some VB.NET code from 2003. You know, like pre-generics, pre-everything. I have a little utility that generates code that wraps a database. And, you know, it's straight ADO.NET, just makes a little wrapper layer. And makes it where I don't have to deal with the Entity Framework and in hibernating all these things for really fast-performing applications, you know, so I have, you know, stored procs that take table value variables and all that kind of junk. And, you know, that works great. But we decided that on the side project to start pulling that code out and, you know, switching where that code is generated by an app, because I've been having a lot of hosting problems with the T4 templates talking to Visual Studio, and there's a lot of back and forth. Plus, I now found that I can't just generate one file. I need to generate several. And as a result, I've been moving over to making a WinForms app. Well, for all the little pieces where I want to have separate settings, I was like, hey, let's use a property grid, because that'll be fun. You know, use a property grid, they said. It'll be fun, they said, right? And, yeah, it... I forgot how many things about WinForms really frustrated me, because it's been a little while since I've done anything really substantial in there. And I had to kind of dig around and deal with displaying collections in a custom manner, because it turns out if something's an IEnumerable, it wants to pop up a little deal where you can add and remove things.
Yeah. Well,
one of the things it adds and removes, you know, or the way that was set up was tables and views and all that stuff. And I'm like, I don't want to add to SQL. I want them to do that through SQL. This is just settings for those tables and views, like how the code generator library deals with it. So they don't add anything ever on those. I showed you before we started the podcast, there's a little button with an ellipsis, you know, the three periods on there that goes to add and remove. I went through about, I guess it was 2.5 hours of work just trying to get that stupid thing to go away. I had to make a custom type descriptor, and I had to make custom property descriptors, and I had generics in the mix. I had reflection in the mix. And then the best sample I had for how to do this and make it go away was in VB.NET 2003. So, of course, it doesn't have the other constraints in the mix either. And so I'm like having to port it and try to think about what's going on. And it was a little bit painful.
I can only imagine.
Yeah. And actually, the way I ended up doing it, my partner on my side project was coming into town. He was in over the weekend. And he was going to be in at like, you know, 4:30, 5 o'clock. And this was like noon when I found this out. And so I actually mentally said, I've got to have this done by the time he gets here. Even though the thing is, I really didn't have to have it done by then. But I actually used that, because if I can completely freak out, I can actually pressure myself into coding faster and getting things done sometimes. And it worked. And I got away with it. But yeah, it was pretty rough. So, yeah. What about you? You've been dealing with any old code lately?
Well, old code for me would be QBasic or C++.
C++ is still legit. I guess QBasic might be somewhere.
Well,
like somewhere in Patagonia or something.
To be honest, to even get a hold of any old code of mine, I would have to go find a machine that still used the hard floppies.
I might have one.
I don't have those floppies either, so it doesn't matter. This week's been, it's not been a lot of coding for me this week. It's just been really, really busy.
Those are the worst.
Yeah, not exactly, because by busy, I mean, I have, two interviews already set up for this coming week, thanks to the busyness of last week. I started putting out applications after the first of the year, just because that's when the tech industry kind of picks back up, and it's really paid off.
Holy crap, has it picked back up? My phone was going off constantly today. Recruiters, like, hitting my LinkedIn profile. It's like, you know, and our mutual friend who, he who shall not be named, he would like that name. We'll start calling him that. He who shall not be named was sitting behind me.
He'd get a kick out of that.
He would. His phone was going off too. He's like, who's hiring? And I'm like, dude, it's the second week of January. He goes, oh.
Yeah. I mean, I got a call today on the way over here from a recruiter in Houston, Texas.
I got one from Florida and one from New York and one from Utah.
Utah. That's,
I actually know why that one happened. But,
well, I know why the one in Houston happened, because she works for the same company that I've been working with here in Nashville. And, I've also been talking to someone from that company up in Cleveland, Ohio, where my baby sister lives.
And that's the one I talked to last week with the, one of the referrals.
Yes.
Yeah. So if you guys are looking to hire Beige, you need to hurry.
Yeah.
Cause it's happening real soon.
Exactly. And, I've been doing that, and then my uncle passed away almost a year ago, and when he passed, he left his house to my mom. My parents have been doing a lot of renovations to the house. My uncle and my aunt were both smokers, so they've torn out all the carpet and stuff, and recently my mom asked me to come down and replace the electrical and light switches.
And your hair is sticking up right now. Yes. So I assume it wasn't such a good day.
It was a bit of a shocking day today. I spent the afternoon finishing up down there.
Did your mom tell you were grounded, or did physics?
It was more of a physics thing, to be honest. I will say this. If you follow me on social media, you've already seen me say it, but understanding the physics behind electrical circuits and the wiring of a house can be very different at times.
Yes.
And I was very good. Of course, I'm very paranoid about stuff. So I tested every outlet before working on it. However,
because the outlet doesn't work doesn't mean the wire doesn't work. Is that what happened?
No. Friday, when we started working on this, my mom went around and unscrewed all the outlets so I could have easier access. It'd be just quicker to go around to each one and replace them. Well, the one in the washroom, I went to test it to see if it had power. I thought I turned it off, but I wanted to make sure. And because she'd unscrewed it, it was kind of hanging face down.
Yeah.
So I went to pick it up from the outside edges to turn it so that I could plug in the tester. And
it tested it.
Yeah, I tested it for sure. It had some loose connections, and it was a very shocking experience. Pun intended.
Oh, that's bad.
And so, well,
it stinks when you work like that and you meet resistance.
Actually, the resistance isn't that bad.
That's true.
It's when you don't have the resistance that the problem happens.
So to complete the circuit. I guess it's about time to roll the music.
It sure is. This week for IoTs, I have something that I've seen on a few different websites that I like to look at for IoT. It is called FooBot, and it is an indoor air quality monitor. It monitors the air quality of your home or office and sends an alert to your smartphone. It's an interesting device, especially if you have allergies and want to know more about the air quality in your environment.
That's interesting, although I don't know that, you know, the office that we record in, which is my office, I don't know that we'd want to plug one of those in there. I think it would take the cell phone battery down. The air alerts.
Well, yeah.
It's a little funky down here right now.
No.
It's a neat little device, and especially if you have allergies or if your kids have allergies and you kind of want to monitor the environment that you are there in, a little on the expensive side. I think it's about $200 for that.
So in this episode, we're going to talk about how to write better technical specs. And part of the reason we're doing this is, well, first of all, because I'm doing that at work right now for a project, and Beej just got done doing that for a side project. And so I figured we would kind of talk and he could kind of explain what he did.
Will had a client with his business. And since I'm kind of interning or apprenticing with him.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what we call that. You know, it's like LinkedIn doesn't have an idea of what a apprentice is versus a junior developer, because you typically shield junior developers from like all the painful, difficult stuff. You give them enough where they can learn and grow, but where it doesn't just absolutely obliterate them. And like, I don't protect you at all.
Well, no, and you shouldn't, because it's just our dynamic and me. It just doesn't work that way.
Well, and I'm too lazy, to be honest. I'm just not going to do that. So I'd kind of asked Beej to build these specs for a client for a website that he wants. And so I guess if you want to kind of go through the description sort of what you did, and maybe that'll help some.
Yeah, sure. That's no problem. Well, honestly, this was the first time I've ever built technical specs. I've researched it and done some exercises in my learning on them, but first time I'd ever done one for a client. And I think it turned out pretty well for a first try.
Yeah, it really did. I mean, part of the deal was to throw you into the fire.
It really did, because I came at it with the, all right, I need to create a wireframe. Then I found kind of like I kind of took a model of a technical specs and used that as a basis, which turned out to be really good. The only problem I ran into is the particular website was a WordPress site. And wireframe did not work as well as just going and setting up a free WordPress account and practicing on that until I had exactly what he was looking for.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's part of the problem too with specs, especially if you're dealing with a project manager, because they don't write code. You know, or a graphic designer too, they'll get you with this too. Is they can, you know, they can say, oh, they can design something that you can't build with the technology there.
Yeah.
And this was especially true of the web even just a few years ago.
Well, the other thing I ran into is everything I've done up until this point has been for either myself or for us as
And you had another developer on the other end. And it's a completely different game when you have somebody else. Mm-hmm. That's not what they do.
And it wasn't that he made any unrealistic requests.
No, he's one of the easiest people to work with that I deal with. And that's part of the reason that I sent him your way. The other reason was because he wanted a podcast and you kind of did the site. And I was like, well, I could figure out what he did or he could do it.
And it worked out really well. He and I have communicated a lot via email. And
you've known each other for, what, 15 years?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, almost as long as you've known me. Yeah. So it's, you know, I think that was a pretty good way to do it.
Oh, it was a great introduction to working directly with the client, because
part of it is the discoverability of what the other party wants, which is a whole nother thing.
Exactly. I kind of discovered when it came to fonts and colors, I gave him the options, and the opposite of the one I personally would choose was the one that he picked. Well, yeah, and that's not, you know, good or bad. That's just subjective. Personal preference.
And that was sort of the point. You know, like I said, this is why I threw you in the fire on this, is because that's the only way you're going to learn. You know, there's a whole lot of stuff that gets said about how you build effective specifications, particularly when working with clients. But even when you're doing stuff with fairly technical stuff internally, it's very different than it's made out to be. So it's good that you got to learn this. And so that's kind of why we're doing this.
I also learned about the dynamic aspect of development, where I would get we would have the basics down, and then it would come to, you know, the font choices.
Yeah.
And what I would think would look good, he would think something else looked good. And I think we've talked about this before, where I talked about the JavaScript code I wrote to just sort of display a bunch of different fonts.
Yeah, that was a good hack. That was a good way to handle that.
Well, it worked out. He appreciated it because it gave him options.
A lot of times it feels like, at least from the development end, that specs don't matter, except when they matter, and then they're the only thing that matters. Because most of it really is the relational aspect between you and the other party.
Yes.
The specs are you codifying that, but no, they're not.
I developed the specs, and I wrote them up, and I sent them to you. You approved them, and then we sent them to him.
Yep.
He approved the specs. Of course, that didn't have the personal detail, like the color scheme and the fonts and things like that.
Well, and I saw that going out.
Yeah, it had the layout and, you know, how we were going to set up the podcast and how we were going to do, you know, kind of the back end stuff in the site.
Yeah, and part of that was teaching you that, hey, you got to think about those things. But part of it, too, is the fact that you can't.
Yeah.
Because really, until you get there, those pieces don't fall into place.
Well, that's what I learned with doing the wireframe, partly because I went a little overboard with the wireframe. I put a lot of design into it.
Yeah, I was, you know, that's one of those things that I can only, like, you can almost only teach that with pain.
Yeah.
Although I really, to some degree, I kind of wish I'd intervened a little earlier, because I wanted you to learn it with pain so you remembered it, but not maybe that much.
Stubborn.
Yeah.
And I keep going because you told me to build a wireframe for it, and I just...
Well, and I wasn't necessarily trying to waste your time on it, because you still need to have the skill of building wireframes and doing all those pieces, but part of it is getting you into the mindset of trying to figure out what sort of spec to build. And so I guess it's probably a good time now to kind of go through... I've got a bulleted list here of things to kind of help you build a spec better in the future. And I think you probably learned most of these as you went through, or you already knew them. There's a few on here that are kind of obvious. So I guess we'll start this out. The first thing is start with the end in mind. When you're building out a spec, outline it first. And there's a couple of reasons for this, all right? You know, there's three or four really good reasons for this. The first is that helps you avoid large, you know, gross logical and structural errors. Things like, oh, I didn't think about the database. Yeah. You'd be surprised how often that happens, where somebody writes a spec and then you get a group together and everybody looks at it and they're like, well, what's this look like on storage? Well, I don't know. And it's because they didn't outline it. They just started writing. So,
you know, one thing that I have noticed, and this is more from doing the podcast than anything, is do you remember... I guess junior high, high school is when we first started really doing this. But whenever we would write a paper, or they'd be teaching us to write a paper, we would have to, you know, submit an outline and go through this whole process. Yeah.
And that's actually not the way I write now. Not entirely. No. But
you know what? That's how I write technical stuff. That's if I'm writing...
And I saw that as part of your process. And this was something that... You already had this.
What I'm getting at is I've really seen the value in it through mainly doing the podcast and blogging, because we write outlines for the podcast, and from there...
Sometimes at the absolute last minute.
Well, yeah, there's that. But we write outlines for the podcast, and from there we develop the... You know, through talking, we develop the episode.
You got to have a skeleton to hang meat off of.
And I do that too when I write my blog posts. Is I find it's easier for me to write a post if I come up with, even if it's just a very basic outline of what I want to say before I type it out, because I tend to stay more on topic with that.
The other reason is, or another reason is, that it allows you to break things into reasonable sized chunks. So, like, if you're doing the Pomodoro technique thing, or if your day's broken up by meetings, you're not starting in the middle of a gigantic piece. You're starting, you know, in a discrete boundary, and you have a certain amount of stuff to get done. It's a lot easier to check things off the list and feel like you're making progress versus this long slog. Like, if you had to write a 200-page document, you'd go crazy. But how bad would it bother you to, I don't know, write 40 5-page documents? it's not anywhere near as bad, even though it's the same length. It's because it's a discrete scope, and you can cover that scope. And you take a break, and you reward yourself and all that. It just the last of the reasons is for building the outline first is that makes it a little bit easier to work with another person. I know the project I'm working on at work right now, we started with a somewhat smaller scope, and then we got into the larger discussions of, oh, hey, it could do this and it can do this, and the document just ballooned. Now, it all landed on me, but it could have landed on me and a coworker. And if it wasn't broken up into an outline, I wouldn't be able to hand that off because it would just be it's just this glob of work. So you're going to have to do that anyway if you're going to collaborate with other people. So it's better to have this up front because that gives you more flexibility when that comes down. Plus, it makes it easier to work on and easier to track your progress and everything else. The next thing I like to do is before I really write the main body of the document, now that I've got the outline, this is sort of a weird workflow, but this is what I use. The next thing I do is I begin the document with a statement of why and the goals for that project. So, what's the problem? I have a paragraph or two of, describing the problem that we have. And then I have a paragraph or two describing what the solution should do without getting into implementation specific details.
So this is in the layout of the document, but I guess my question is when you're actually writing the document, is this something that you always do first before you write the body?
Yes, because it's not really an intro. It's a statement of intent. And the idea here being that somebody reads the spec and they go, okay, here's the problem we have. Here's how we, here's a rough idea of what we want to do to solve it. Not implementation specific. So it's
more like an abstract.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of along those lines.
Okay.
Maybe not even that specific. Mm-hmm. It's, we have problems. I'm trying to think of tracking feature utilization in our software. We don't know what the users are doing. And as a result, we can't focus development efforts on the most important tasks. That's the problem. The solution is we need a system to collect that data anonymously from the client machines and send it back to the server.
So you're restating the problem. You're stating the problem, and then you're stating
what management wants as an answer.
What you want the solution to be, and then in the technical spec, you're
fleshing it out.
Yeah. Okay, that makes perfect sense.
And there's a couple of reasons I do this, or there's, it's like a lot of things. I've really got several reasons, but there's one main one. And the main one is really, it's more about office politics than anything else. You'll be surprised how often this comes up mm-hmm. when you start going through my thought processes. But that shows your initial assumptions, and that helps other people understand you. So as you're working with management, instead of going off somewhere for a week and writing a document and then coming back and being completely wrong, you restate the assumptions and go, okay, is this correct?
Well, that comes back to even just communication with other people.
Yes.
Somebody tells you something, you restate it back to them to show your understanding and that you're paying attention.
Yeah. Well, the other thing it does is it gets buy-in because, hey, your manager just said, yeah, that's exactly what we mean. And
yeah,
that's a good way to put that. Or it's off a little bit, and you're getting a little bit more detail, and that also reduces the backbiting and some of the other things that happen in organizations that are dysfunctional. You got to bear in mind, my mindset is dealing with dysfunctional organizations. I come in and I clean stuff up a lot of times. I'm not doing that now, which is a welcome relief. But the other thing that it does, let's say that you have a manager that's requesting you build a spec for something, but it's for another department. You write that out and you send it to somebody in that other department, the principal on the other side. Mm-hmm. That also pulls them into the loop and they can add other things because sometimes when stuff comes down through management, your manager may not know the full scope of what's going on. They may have heard it secondhand, third hand. It may have a lot of times, especially when you're in these big organizations that are siloed, mm-hmm. The person that, I always pick on accounting people. I don't really know why. I deal with a lot of them. Let's say that there's an accountant that needs something that gets in the GL system. They tell their manager. Their manager tells their manager. They tell the CFO. And then the CFO and the CIO are in a meeting together. the CIO then tells the development, you know, team lead or whatever, who tells the project manager, who writes some stuff up and then sends it over to the senior dev, who then sends it to you. Well, that's a heck of a game of telephone. And you really don't want that. You just want to go and say, okay, let me rephrase the problem and make sure I understand it. Because you see what you just did? You just made a bridge right across that. You short-circuited that. So that if you can get around that organizational structure, that really, really helps you. And it makes you look a lot more effective than you really are. Because you're actually, you're shifting the environment that you're working in compared to other people. So it actually looks good and you're more effective. You get more stuff done. But if everybody was doing that, it'd be a fair game. But, you know, it's like the mindset of don't ever be in a fair fight, because if you're in a fair fight, you're tactically stupid. This is how you end up in a situation where you have the advantage and leverage from the beginning. And I think you kind of had that, although you didn't just like completely lay it out there, because a lot of that with what you had was, well, he wants to run a podcast and he's kind of doing the same stuff we're doing. So the statement was implicit. Mm-hmm. It might have helped you a little bit had you laid it out, you know, in writing, which you kind of ended up doing anyway with the spec. Yeah. But had you done that at the beginning of the spec that and pass that off to him before you started writing the rest, that might have actually saved you a little bit of pain. It wouldn't have saved you the masochism you had with the wireframes. That was all you.
Well, but, yeah, like I said, I'm stubborn, and when I'm told do it this way,
yeah,
I will do everything in my power to do it the way I'm told to do it.
You did. You hit it pretty hard. Those were some darn good mock-ups. Okay, and the other thing, and I tend to the third point here is I tend to end with a statement of risks to the project and or questions. So when you write a spec, it's not, at least the way I think of them, is not necessarily a completely dry document. There will be some questions in there in line. And one thing that comes up with this is that one thing that shows you who actually read it, because the people that actually read it will answer you. Whereas the guy that's just kind of schmoozing and trying to wing it won't. And the thing is when you make that guy stand out, it's obvious to everybody else in the room. You don't have to do anything, because everybody goes, he didn't read it.
Yeah. And it doesn't even look like you're trying to.
Well, but you've got questions. They're right there. Yeah. And they're in the spec and they're points of discussion. So you put those at the end as, you know, risks / points of discussion. And, you know, the risks, you do need to cover those.
Well, that is important, yeah.
Yeah, and it's more of a matter of, okay, what could sideline this project? What could cause problems? If you're at that scope, if you're just doing implementation, maybe not so much. Mm-hmm. But if you lay those things out, for one thing, it's forward thinking. The other thing is you really need to have that. Because you're going to eventually encounter a hostile customer or a hostile somebody, or somebody's just having a bad day. And having all your ducks in a row beforehand just makes everything so much smoother. Because if you get rid of that initial problem, and there's some people that you'll deal with too that come off as just complete jerks. And then once they realize you're competent, you're good. That doesn't mean you slack off, but, you know, like they get protective of you because, hey, you already passed the test. So this sort of helps with that.
Several people
like I'm like that, that yeah. sometimes.
The thing is, if you start to slack off, they will catch you on it.
Yes.
And they'll call you out on it too.
Yeah.
But you've passed the initial.
Yeah. You're not gone. You're fixable.
Yeah. And sometimes if you pass that, and you slack off, they'll come to you with what's going on, because they know, because they've got that mindset of, all right, he's not a slacker, and what is it that's...
Yeah, what's going on there? Mm-hmm. It's, you got to bear in mind, if you write a specification, it is a political document. Get it out of your head right now that it's just the spec, because it's not. It's the thing that the rest of the team coalesces around. And it's very political, so you need to play that game a little bit.
Well, I mean, even with that, like, we've been talking about the one that I wrote for the client that you have, and recently I was dealing with a medical issue and didn't respond to a couple of emails just because I was pretty much out of commission for about 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
And I got an email from him that said, hey, are you okay? Because I normally respond within 24 hours, usually.
Yeah, and I should have sent him, I should have sent him a message too. Of course, I didn't hear from you, but I was like, well, he said something about kidney stones. So I was, and part of the deal is because I was kind of,
Well, it also was over holidays. And so it's kind of, there's a lot going on. And so, when he sent me the email, it was like, hey, is everything okay? I haven't heard from you in a few days,
Yeah, it's better just to set people up where they can give you the benefit of the doubt without looking like a schmuck.
Yeah.
Because if they do that, that most people are not jerks.
Mm-hmm.
And if you set things up that way, they can do it and they will do it and you deserve it, or you're more deserving of it versus if you're a screw up.
I guess, and I think this was a good example, and you can tell me yay or nay, but, he had had a few questions. A couple of things weren't working the way he wanted them to. And so when I did get on, a couple of days later and responded to his email, I got on and I explained what was going on and then told him how to solve the problem that he was having.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like I didn't respond immediately.
Yeah, you still had to be competent.
Yeah.
Like you can't go, oh, the spec is all political and I'm just not going to write a good spec. You have to write a good spec, but you also have to bear in mind, you have to help build the team in a way that is going to work so that the spec actually happens. And, these are sort of the things that you kind of have to think about. And I know that that sounds like something that developers should ignore. We should all be purists and we should sit there and, write code in Vim on Linux and not worry about the rest of the world. But that's really not how anything works. Like, isolationism just doesn't cut it.
It would be nice.
Would it?
For some people, it would be really nice. It would be their ideal way of doing things. But you're an outgoing introvert, and it would not be nice for you. I'm an outgoing extrovert, and it would not be nice for me.
The thing is though, they could toil away on something that's wrong.
It's true.
And waste a year of their life. I mean, you don't want to do that. That's what these documents are for. So, yeah. So it's just more of a way to get in front of potential problems rather than ignoring mm-hmm. them. So that's why I like to put that there. Plus, if somebody brings up during a meeting, they go, oh, there's this, this, and this that are risks to this project. And you go, well, yeah, I actually had that as a discussion point afterward. I just stuck that at the end and figured we'd get back to it. That way you can defang that snake right there, put it into a context. And bear in mind, you just took control of the situation. And all the other people who are probably stakeholders, possibly on the other side of that argument, they got a little time to think. And everybody's got time to cool off and work it out instead of it being a reactionary thing. So this is very important. That's why I put that in there.
I could see this reducing not just the time of meetings, because when you've got those reactions, you got reactions from both sides coming out. Whereas when both sides have a chance to calm down, focus on what is really on what they want to say, it does reduce some of that reactionary time, that some of the time that's taken up by reactions, but also
it gets rid of the irritation and the stress.
Yeah, it reduces the stress. That's kind of where I was going. Yeah, it reduces the stress of that, and it makes for an overall better work environment.
Yeah, it's just better to avoid stupid, painful things.
Yeah, exactly.
It's pretty much that's like the whole point of evolution. That's why we're not still plowing fields with sticks, is because it kind of hurts. So another thing, and this is the one that you learned in excess, I guess. you learned it fervently.
Yes.
Is don't build full UI prototypes. I mean, unless you're a designer, then you're stuck on that. Instead, use a tool that makes it obvious that it's a prototype. That's why I like Balsamiq.
Yeah.
It's scratchy. It looks like you drew it out with a pen. It's very obvious that this is not what the final product looks like, but it's the general layout and how the pieces fit together. And this does several things. Again, bear in mind, this is a political document. It's a specification too, but understand that it is political. It keeps a lot of distracting discussions about minute details out.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have some joker on there going, I can't believe he used sans serif fonts for that. Oh my goodness. Because there's always that one guy that is got nothing else to do than worry about font kerning all day. So you're going to run into that person. They don't like an image. They don't like the width of a border. They don't like the font kerning. They don't like the font style. Some junk, and it's distracting at this point. There's always going to be somebody like that. And a lot of them are people that really aren't that important, but they want to look important. Mm-hmm. This cuts that junk out because it's just a general layout thing.
I have noticed that people who want to look important will find... I've even caught myself doing this, is you find something to nitpick.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I freely do that. Yeah. But, and, you know, I sound like a complete sociopath when I admit it. But, I mean, that's kind of a human trait. It's the difference between saying, I'm a musician and listen to my song. And most of this is actually political because that's really what a spec is. This is why people fail, is because they don't realize that. Another thing that happens here is that it makes it really clear that it's a mock-up and it's not the finished product. You would be absolutely shocked by how many clients think a mock-up is the finished thing. So, like, let's say that you build a system, you know, you build a quick mock-up. Like, let's say that you're a complete masochist and you do this in Access. Okay, this happened a lot in the late 90s. Somebody would build a system up and they go, okay, yeah, we're going to build a real system that's using C++ and talking to the database. But here's a mock-up that we did in Access using the designer just to give an idea. And you know what the client says? Ship it. And then what do? You're in a defensive, reactive position. You don't want to ever be there. Like, it's the way you want to make it very clear. Hey, this is a mock-up. This isn't how this is going to look. Exactly. It's a layout idea. And that kind of gets that out of the way without having to, you know, go crazy explaining things. So it's just a way of avoiding pain. The other thing is, it's just flat out easier. I mean, how long did you spend? Yeah, and nobody listening can see the look on his face, but he looks like he just ate a green persimmon. I don't know if anybody, there's probably a few people out there that have, but they're really tart and they give you like this awful cotton mouth. It's not something you want to eat. And his face just looked like that because he just thought about all the time he spent on that. And if I'd realized that you were packing that much time into those few days like that, I would have stopped you before then because I wanted you to do some mocking up and get the experience. Well, I didn't want you to get all the experience right then. The next thing you need to do when you're building one of these things is actually lay out your implementation in a logical, consistent manner. Typically, the way I do this is I start with the database and I work out because the most valuable thing to the clients I deal with is the data. The rest of it is something that creates the data, mm-hmm. as far as they're concerned. It's like, yeah, it's pretty, it's nice, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that makes
but
sense.
The data is the thing that's valuable. And so I start there to make sure that all the constraints are satisfied, that we've got all the pieces. And then I build a layer on top. You know, so like I'll design all the tables and all their interactions and all this. You know, I don't typically do the stored procedure type level stuff. You know, I leave some things open to the programmer, mainly because I don't have a good way of writing that down, where it's not just writing SQL on paper.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. Now, and see that kind of stuff, like when you guys were working on your side project, Agulus, which you've mentioned a few times, as part of my learning, you guys let me watch that process of you developing that. That is fascinating to me.
Yeah, and we work out. A lot of people don't. They work from the front end back, mm-hmm. which is okay, too, because they're user-focused.
Well, I mean...
And part of it, too, is just mindset, mm-hmm. because I think a lot of the younger developers, they didn't come from a world where, hey, the database is the big thing. They came from a world where, hey, the UI is the big thing, and we don't really care about the database. We'll shove it in the document database somewhere, and, you know, we'll tune that if we need to. So they've got a different perspective. It's fine either way. You just start at one end and work to the other, or start at the logical place and work out.
I think I have a unique perspective because, you know, being the same or similar age as you and having coded and learned programming back in the 90s in high school and then coming into it as a junior developer now, I kind of see both sides of that. And, like, the technical spec I wrote was very heavily UI because it was – creating a website to allow, you know, to move a blog to a blog and podcast.
Yeah.
So it was like the purpose was UI.
Right. Whereas a lot of the stuff I do is still you know, it's pretty data heavy. It's not quite, you know, like machine learning level, but there's a lot of stuff. And so that tends to be the logical progression. Plus, yeah. I tend to work with a lot of developers that think that way. Mm-hmm. And a lot of more senior technical people that have, they've come up through that. And so that's the best way to get a concept across to them. If I started with UI, that would throw them a little bit. Like, it puts them on edge. So you got to think about how your audience is going to be receiving.
That makes sense. Like you said, like,
it's all political.
Even still, when you're explaining things to me, I understand it better when you start with
the, yeah, what the data is.
The data is. Yeah, because that's just...
Well, I mean, that's the ultimate...
The origin of my knowledge of programming comes from that same model.
Yes. Yeah. Whereas if you were 15 years younger, I would have to do it backwards of what I think. And either that or I would have to make you an outlier, basically. Yeah. You would be the one weirdo in your generation. So you do want to be kind of consistent and, you know, start building the layers on top of each other. One thing that you're going to notice, you know, as you go through this, sometimes you'll find things in one layer. You're like, oh, crud, I forgot this further down. Yeah, so we'll come back to how to deal with that. But that sort of helps your design process because you're doing all one chunk, one level out. You know, if you kind of think this level's good, then you step out and you do the next level. And if there's something wrong, you just have to fix it one level below. And so you get more and more correct on the way out. Whereas if you intermingled it, you're going to be jumping all over the place. And that's just, that's more of, you know, avoiding pain. The next thing is use headings to denote your outline levels. So like we discussed doing an outline, but don't do that in raw text. Like use Word, use HTML, use something where you can say, hey, this is an H1, this is an H2. And step in. This helps you build a table of contents. It makes it easier to jump around the document. It's easier on the reader, so they don't hate you when they're reading it.
Like when I wanted to learn Markdown and started writing our show notes in Markdown.
Yeah, except it would be like that. Except it would work.
Hey, it worked when you were looking at the code. It was only when you tried to look at the product of that code that it didn't quite work out for show notes.
Yeah. So, like I said, it makes it easier to refer to portions of the document. This is really handy at meetings where you're like, oh, no, this is here, and we're handling it this way. You can say you can refer to this. Well, if they have the outliner mode up in Word, they can click on that instead of scrolling up and down and, oh, or, you know, whatever. Or if they, you know, it's a bigger text that they can find it on the page easier, and so you're not having people rustle papers. It avoids a little bit of tension. And it doesn't feel like you're put on the spot. Because, like, if somebody asks you a question about something and you answer it and then they're rustling papers for 3 or 4 minutes trying to find it, it just puts a weird air on the whole thing. Whereas they're like, oh, that's right there. Okay, I got you. And they move on and it's fine. It avoids that.
There's also a part just on public speaking on having the outline set aside, basically, so that you can say, oh, well, that's covered in section 3.B number 1 on page 62.
Yeah. It just really helps. It makes a lot of things easier. And it also makes it easier when you're writing because you can move pieces around. Because, you know, in Word and some of these other editors, you can actually drag those pieces. So if you go, hey, this is dumb. Why am I starting at the database? The biggest thing in our app is the UI. Mm-hmm. Well, I just drag the UI piece above where the database is, and I drag the database piece down below where the business layer is. I just switch the entire flow of the document with two mouse clicks and drags. It's just easy. The next point, I know we were kind of burning through time a little faster than I was expecting because we like to expound a little bit more. This is why we have outlines, by the way, so that we don't go off topic for extended periods of time, even though we actually do and we cut it out of the Audacity file, but that's another thing altogether. As you write, you're going to find issues with stuff you wrote before. One thing you must not do is go fix them right then.
Why is that?
Write it down. Write down what you got to do and come back to it when you're at a logical breaking point. Because you'll do, and I mean, I'm not real good about following this, but this is how you end up with a sentence that, you know, is in the middle of a paragraph and has no predicate. Because you said, oh, that's dumb what I did 4 pages ago. And you go back and you fix that and you spend a half hour. And then you go to you go to lunch and you come back and then you forget completely where you were. And you will not, especially if you're in a hurry mm-hmm. writing this and proofreading it, you're not going to see that. You'll read right past it and you'll never notice it. But your manager will.
This is why I had to have all of my papers in college proofread.
Yep.
Which was really nice because the...
Well, we're going to get to that here in a minute.
But one of the things that the school offered was a proofreading service.
Yeah.
And it was either them or I had you proofread it.
Yeah. Well, the thing is you don't want to break your flow for this because of the obvious errors and because it breaks your attention up. And that's like, you want to stay in that flow state. It's sort of like programming with the distractions like we were talking about before. It's very similar in a lot of ways. Another thing is a lot of times when something comes up and you go, oh, I can fix that with whatever this new idea is. Sometimes if you let it mellow a little bit, you'll actually come up with something better. And if you immediately went and fixed it, now you got to rewrite it twice.
And
fix all the places in the document that were referring to it. It's a pain.
Or you may think, this great idea might pop in your head. Throw it down. I use my phone a lot for that. I mean, you've probably seen me several times.
Oh, yeah.
Pick up my phone and I'm putting stuff into the notepad on my phone. But I'll write the idea down and then come back to it a little later and look at it and go, you know what? That's really not that good of an idea. Most of the times.
Or it's fodder for a much bigger idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the thing that gets me. And is if I chase that right now, I'm not going to get done with what I'm doing.
And I have a lot of trouble with that just because my personality is I like to follow.
Yes. And I'm the same way, and I understand that tendency, and that's why I have this practice in place. I think it really helps a lot.
The trick is, because I'm that way, if I don't do that, if I don't have some kind of outlet for it...
You'll be thinking about it anyway. You've got to get it out on paper.
Yeah. Well, just that, and if I don't have some kind of outlet for following those little rabbit trails, it's one of the reasons I like playing video games, is because that gets that... I can go... Especially like the open world sandbox kind of games, is I can go follow that rabbit trail.
And get all the way to the end of it and then go do something else. Whereas when you're writing,
you can't do that. But if I have an outlet for that, then when I'm writing and I can't do that, I don't feel trapped and...
Well, and here's the other thing. Okay, your brain just told you, it spit something out that said, hey, here's an idea.
Mm-hmm.
When your brain's doing that, you don't want to stop it and go, hey, let's go implement that. Yeah. You want it to keep going. That's a very valuable mental state that you don't want to squander.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you're also trying to work. So you either get the idea down and more come after it, and you get those down, or more don't, and you finish what you're doing, and then you go back. And that avoids inconsistency in the thing you're working on. Plus, it allows you to focus completely on the idea when it's in a proper context.
Yeah. Well, I think what I was getting at was, if you're like me, like you, it's good to have some form of outlet where...
You have to. I mean...
You're allowed to go follow those, where you don't have to sit and, put it down somewhere else and then go back to what you were doing, where you can just go, oh, that's a good idea. I'm curious about that. I'm just going to follow this.
That's why programmers have side projects. That's exactly why most of them do. Of course, we talked about the whole inconsistency thing. You know, that jumping down the rabbit hole is a great way to have those kind of problems because it just breaks your focus. So it's best avoided. Another thing, once you've written the spec, if you have a day or two or longer after completion, put it in a desk and go do something else.
Well, that's just a good idea with anything you write. They suggest this even with papers, like English papers in college.
Yeah, blog posts, papers, anything of that sort. If you put it away for a couple of days and come back, you'll see things that you didn't see before.
Well, it's like with the podcast. The best episodes we've had were ones that I was able to finish on like Monday or Tuesday with the complete editing.
Yeah.
Have the MP3 out by Monday or Tuesday. Listen to it before publishing. Go back through. And so there have been several times I've listened to it and gone back and fixed things. If you hear big errors like echoes. That's one of the big things. If you hear echoes and stuff like that, it usually means something came up and I was I wasn't able to go back and re-listen to the episode before Thursday morning when we publish.
Yeah, and I think developers, a lot of times, we don't really have the concept of the editorial cycle, and it's really unfortunate, especially with things that we write, because the other thing is we also are very used to looking at stuff that looks a lot like English but isn't. Yes. Especially, let me give a shout out to all the VB programmers out there. If not, is null. You know, and you have this weird drug-addled Yoda syntax that comes out, and you'll read it, and it doesn't bother you at all. And anybody else just goes, is this something wrong with him? And so it's good to have a couple of days to let something mellow and then come back and look at it. You know, the deal is especially with grammar mistakes, those tend to make your viewpoint look weaker, even if you're technically sound. If you misspell words, you know, you do that sort of thing, it makes people less confident in your technical ability. It shouldn't, because I know some very, very good developers who cannot write for crap.
I know a few.
And it's unfortunate, because what happens is when you get into a meeting with them, people start picking their ideas apart because they go, well, this guy, you know, his punctuation, and it's not even little stuff. It's not like he didn't use the Oxford comma. Which just makes him an unwashed heathen. But forgot a period on a sentence, or you know, weird capitalization, or just grossly misspelling things. And it weakens your argument, and you don't want to be in that position, because you want to be in a position of power. Another thing that happens with another read through is that gives you a little bit more confidence, because you remember not just what you're thinking, but what you actually said. Sometimes those are different, and that can be a political thing. That can be I don't want to expose these non-tech people to heavy tech stuff and get them intimidated or bogged down or trying to understand, you know, computing concepts. Like if you're trying to do something with a neural network and you've got, you know, some marketing guy over here, that's not a real good time to get into that explanation. So what you actually wrote and what you're thinking, they may not be the same thing. And so it's good to get another read through. This is also good right before a meeting, is read your document again, before you go in there, so it's in your head. It's fresh.
That's just good advice for, even if it's not your document, even if it's a meeting that someone else is having, reading through it right before you go in, just like you said, it puts it fresh in your mind.
Yes. And you want to use that fast access memory that you have. It's your short-term memory, because you're built for that. Like, you're optimized.
And if it's something that's really long, like, I know, in school, and this is...
Well, if it's very long, it's not going to be the whole subject of the meeting anyway. If it is, you should avoid the meeting.
Yeah. What I'm getting at is, if it's something long, like an entire chapter...
Yeah.
And for school, what I would do is I would go through and look at... the outline of the chapter.
Well, and for something like that, do you highlight?
Mm-hmm. Well, that doesn't work in med school.
Yeah.
Because if you try to highlight...
You highlight the whole book. The next thing you do, after you've read through it, I frequently will read it again. But this time I try to get in the head of somebody who's vehemently opposed. Whatever it is, you know, somebody who, I don't know, doesn't like my facial hair or whatever. Who has some nitpicky reason to try to be in their head and read that entire document as if you're opposing it. But that helps you find holes in your arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of a last minute thing before you're actually going into meetings. Although it can be useful when you're building the document, but it's more useful when you're actually dealing with other people.
Yeah.
Because you can find those holes and already be thinking in your head. And it's just one of those things where it makes you look better and look more prepared. And anything you come up with, go ahead and add it to the list of risks, because it's like, oh, hey, you know, yeah, I know you're vehemently opposed to it. You know, you'd like to see me burn at the stake. However, your concerns have been addressed in section C, and now maybe they don't want to burn you at the stake. Maybe they just want to beat you up. It softens the opposition. It's really never that bad.
Either that, or it really, really frustrates them, and they're annoying, and everybody else sees that you.
Yeah, it's a very self-protective mechanism, because again, you know, the problem with a lot of engineers is that they don't think specifications are political documents. If they went into it with the mindset that it is, they'd be fine. And the last thing is run it by somebody else on the team, if possible, before you show it to anybody else. Like, I've got an office mate I'll send a spec over to him before I send it over to the other developers that are in the next office down, including one of the owners of the company. Even though I'm friendly with everybody, I run it by him first and just get another pair of eyes on it. It does a couple things. One is it helps you get buy-in from whoever is with you. So it's not just you against the world. It's this other guy goes, hey, this is all right. And I helped him on these points. And you kind of have a teammate there.
Also, if they, you know, they read through it and if they don't make any changes, they're kind of giving their stamp of approval.
Yeah, and they're going to feel that when they're in a meeting.
Exactly.
If you're getting jumped on, that's a very good prophylactic for that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing it does find errors that you missed.
That's true, because there's a lot of times, like you were saying, you'll read through something and not notice that you only have a half of a sentence because you'll see the full sentence when you read it. I can't tell you how many times in papers I've done that.
And the other thing is loaded words.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's certain words that you don't use because they don't mean anything, or you shouldn't use them.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Like we were talking about RESTful APIs earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Half the time when somebody says that, they just mean that there's an endpoint somewhere that's taking HTTP requests. And they don't really mean REST as in what was in the paper.
Yeah.
You know, they mean, we got an endpoint. Having somebody else that would go, hey, look, this isn't quite on point. Leave that out, and then you avoid that whole...
Yeah, you avoid discussion. The whole situation where you've got to...
Yeah, and you just had the discussion with the one person, and you're taking advice, and it just works better. It's a better flow. So that's the 10 points. And so
I think that covers it all and pretty much wraps it up. Before we close everything out, Will, what do you have for us for Tricks of the Trade?
Well, this ties into last week's Tricks of the Trade a little bit. You know, we kind of have redone it a little bit to ask, you know, to get people to send in questions. And part of the reason for this is what happens to you when you have too many tools.
Yeah, really?
So, yeah, I mean, everybody, you know, there's a few useful tools that you can have. But when you get to a certain point, you have too many pieces of software to actually keep track of.
So
you start,
that.
Yeah, you start thinking about, okay, I got to update all this. I can't remember which app that's in. And so you get too big of a tool chain and it gets to be a problem. And so I kind of want to advise all of y'all out there to start to think a little bit, even though you can have these nice whiz-bang tools that do, you know, one little thing and do it really well. Start making sure that you don't have too many. Because at some point that becomes a cognitive overhead too, and it outweighs the value of the tool. And
so, yeah, I can see that even with beyond software tools, just with physical tools.
You want tools
to do the job, but you know.
And I forget which. There's an opinionated British chef who's on TV, and I cannot remember his name, but he goes off on these useless one-use kitchen tools.
Yeah,
it's like it's a lemon zester that only works on lemons, you know, kind of tool. Not like that. Really,
yeah, I see what you're saying.
It's the same kind of concept. Yeah. It only works on one thing. And he goes, well, what happens when you have that? Well, you can't find anything when you need something. And this sort of happens on your workstation, too, when you get too many things installed. So just give everybody a little moment of zen and start thinking about, you know, simplify a little bit. If you have a question or comment for us, please email us at neckbeards@completedeveloperpodcast.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from Stand By for Titanfall by Pure Bells, available on SoundCloud and licensed under Creative Commons. The intro music for IoTs is OMFG Hello by Argo Fox and is also licensed under Creative Commons and available on SoundCloud. For references, show notes, and to sign up to our email list, be sure and check out the website at www.completedeveloperpodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @CompleteDevPod and like our page on Facebook to keep up with news about the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time.